Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. We're in Chicago for a passing of the torch at the Democratic National Convention. Joe Biden has urged Americans to elect Kamala Harris as his replacement. But what will President Biden do with the time he has left in office? And what is the legacy he wants to leave? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and coming up today in this edition of Focus on Africa, a sexual assault recorded and shared on social media shakes up Tanzania.
It's an incident that has changed the way society views women. And whatever people have been doing in the past with respect to changing the fabric of the society and educating people on women's rights and particularly sexual rights, they've done a good job because the society has changed.
We explore the reasons behind attempts to remove the governor of the Central Bank of Libya.
Well, it's very simple. It's money. The governor has been noting a significant rise in state expenditure over recent years. A lot of this appears to be happening off the books. So the refusal to mobilize more funds has led to the government of national unity to seek to replace him with someone who would sign off on the checks.
And we spill the tea on why the Kenyan government reversed the decision to remove controls on the price of the beverage. It's Tuesday, the 20th of August. First, we go to Dar es Salaam, where a story has appeared that has shaken the nation to its core. A police commander in the capital, Dodoma, was removed from her post after she linked a sexual assault victim to sex work. The case came to public notice earlier this month when a video depicting the assault of a young woman by five men went viral. The video prompted an outcry in Tanzania. The police appeared to ignore the video at first, but then the police commander in Dodoma was quoted in a Tanzanian newspaper to have said the woman in question appeared to be engaged in sex work. That comment enraged people, with many saying it minimized the ordeal of the woman in the video. Tanzania's National Police Force then apologized and said the commander had been relieved of her command. Not quite disciplinary action, but action of some sort, we thought. So we called up Fatma Karume, a Tanzanian lawyer and activist who's been following developments. What was her reaction first to the video?
Well, I couldn't watch the video myself because I didn't have the heart to watch it. But I was extremely touched by the outcry around it. And it didn't come from sort of well-known female figures as such. It came from the society in general. And men were also very disgusted with what happened to this young lady. So that was lovely because you could see that there's a change in the society. And it's not only from women activists, but it's a general feeling of despair that something like this could happen to a young lady and the police services were not going to take any action.
Was that the case? Because I think perhaps for the benefit of our listeners, just give us the high points of it. Because from what I understand, there was a video shared. It showed a woman being assaulted. And then the police commander in Dodoma quoted as saying that the woman in question appeared to be engaged in sex work. But I bet that's not the entire story, is it?
No, it's not. So the video was shared on social media for about 5 days. No action was taken by the police services. And there was a call by the general public for action to be taken. And this took some time. The first thing the police came out and said was that they didn't know the perpetrators. So social media went to work, names were named, pictures were given, even positions of some of these youngsters in the army were shared on social media. Eventually, the police then took action and addressed the general public and said they had arrested these young men. A few days after that, Then we had the police commissioner in Dodoma who came out and said, well, it appears that this young woman was involved in sex work. And there was another outcry because following the alleged arrest, no action had been taken against these young men. They were not taken to court. There was another outcry. And yesterday, the young men were eventually taken to court. The police commissioner for Dodoma was relieved of her position and sent back to headquarters. And it appears that there has been some traction in this case.
So the police commissioner, a woman, said that she had said that even if the woman was a sex worker, she did not deserve to be treated that way. I can see how that could be upsetting. But what did you make of that comment?
Well, the impression we had at the very beginning of the statement was that she said it may have been the woman was a sex worker. Now, she didn't need to say that. She didn't need to say that because her job has nothing to do with consent, whether she's a sex worker or she's not. It appears to me that the comment about the young lady being a sex worker was aimed at making the offense less than what it was, lessening the impact. And this is not acceptable.
And is that how people in general saw it in Tanzania? Or was there discussion about that? I suppose what I'm trying to establish is how do people regard sex workers in Tanzania?
Well, I can't tell you how people generally regard sex workers in Tanzania, but what I can say is that it didn't go down well. The fact that the behavior was trying to be excused due to her alleged profession did not go down well with the general public.
So were you surprised that the commander was essentially disciplined in a way by being relieved? She's not fired, but she has been removed from the position that she held at that point.
It was a pleasant surprise. I don't think I could call it disciplinary action was taken against her. She was just removed. She was moved to send a message, I think, that she wasn't doing a good job. But this in itself is not discipline.
No, but I suppose that the fact that somebody in some way is being held to account in some way by being removed from her post, was that a surprise to you?
It did come as a surprise. Because we hardly ever see this in Tanzania. We do not see accountability. And it's a level of accountability. It's not good enough, but it's a level of accountability. And so it is pleasant. Although I have to say, this is the question, of course, was she held accountable because she's a woman? Or would she have been treated the same way had she been a man?
I suppose you are the only person really in this conversation that can answer that question. What do you think?
My view is that had she been a man, she would not have been treated in the same way.
How are women treated by the police, women in particular?
Look, we have now a section of the police force which is trained to deal with sexual offences, domestic violence, and they work very, very well. So there's been a change in Tanzania towards women's rights. There's a recognition that women have certain rights and that we are, to a certain extent, victims of domestic violence. However, we still have to work harder because the concept that young men can rape a young woman as retaliation. And this is the allegation, that it was retaliatory for her having an affair with a married man.
And this is the allegation, right? And these men who
are... This is the allegation.
And the men who are doing it, what are they to whoever? What is their concern in a way? And also you hinted earlier that they were in the army.
It appears they were hired guns. And this is the transcript. When you listen to the transcript in Kiswahili of the video recording, it appears there were hired guns and the sexual abuse was used to retaliate.
So punitive.
Definitely punitive.
And the men, a suggestion that they may have been in the army?
There is a suggestion that they may have been in the army. There are some images on social media of one of the young men dressed in combat gear. And in Tanzania, unless you're in the army or in the police service, you are not allowed to dress in combat gear. It is illegal. So there is a suggestion that he was in the army or still is in the army.
Have they been charged?
Yes, they were charged yesterday. And today, a social activist has commenced a criminal complaint against the woman who allegedly used these young men to retaliate against, let's say, her husband's affair partner.
Right. So this has got so very many tragic layers to it. We haven't mentioned that Tanzania has a woman president. I'm just wondering whether that has in any way affected the way in which women get treated, regarded, and respected in Tanzania.
I think there is an impact, definitely, when you have a woman at the head of the executive. There is definitely an impact on how people perceive women. What I have to say is that it's a patriarchal society, and it takes a long time to change attitudes towards women. And really, you can't change that attitude just by having one woman at the top. Because the attitude has to change from the homes, from the grassroots. The one thing I can say, the incident that we have recently seen shows a change of attitudes towards sexual violence against women.
You mean the outcry and also then the spokesperson being removed from her post?
Yes, definitely. And we saw men coming out against this. And it was very hopeful for me that there has been a change in the society.
What about the president? Has she said anything about this?
The president has been quiet, has not made any comment. However, and this is the question that, you know, as somebody who is looking at the incident and analyzing it, I do wonder, though, whether the Inspector General of Police would have removed the regional police commissioner for Dodoma without the president's say-so.
Are people expecting the president to say something?
I think it would have been nice for the president to say something, particularly given the violence that was committed against a young woman. But does she comment on social affairs? Rarely.
So there's no real expectation that she would in this case?
No, there isn't. There isn't. I don't expect her to comment. She rarely comments on social outcries or social affairs. And recently she said she will just keep pushing, forging ahead with her agenda. She's not going to be influenced by social outcries. This is maybe her approach to leadership.
Where does this leave Tanzania? There are instances where societies really take stock of themselves. What do you think this has done to the country?
I think this has been a monumental incident, and it's an incident that has changed the way society views women, particularly young women. And I don't think that sexual abuse is going to be something that will be looked upon favorably as a punitive measure to take against women. And whatever people have been doing in the past with respect to changing the fabric of the society and educating people on women's rights and particularly sexual rights, they've done a good job because the society has changed.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much, Fatma. It was very interesting talking to you. And as I say, a point of light at least.
Yes. Thank you, Audrey.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Fatma Karume, a Tanzanian lawyer and activist. A series of unusual events surrounding the central bank in Libya have been unfolding recently. Perhaps we should say unusual even for Libya, because the country has been functioning with levels of dysfunction since the killing of Colonel Gaddafi in the wake of the Arab Spring. The tussle between the Government of National Unity, which holds sway over the western part of Libya, and the governor of the central bank, who holds the purse strings of the oil and gas producing nation, has reached new heights. In short, the government wants to fire Sadiq al-Kabir and replace him with Mohamed Abdul Salama al-Shukri. On top of that, a senior official was abducted and armed men besieged the bank's headquarters, and those men demanded that the governor resign. So why is this happening? Tim Eaton says it's all about the dollar bills. He is a senior research fellow for Middle East and North Africa at Chatham House, and he began at the beginning of the Libya crisis.
Libya, of course, after 2011 and the overthrow of Gaddafi,
initially had a period where it looked like there was going to be consensus-based government. But that really came off the rails by 2014, when there was a fresh outbreak of conflict. And for the most part, since 2014, there have been two rival governments based, one in the west of the country in the capital, Tripoli, and the other in the east of the country. And so after a brief period in 2021, when forces across the country recognized the same government, that split has reemerged from 2022. So as we speak today, there are two governments that claim legitimacy in Libya, one in the west, one in the east. But in reality, those governments are largely under the control of an increasingly limited and entrenched political elite who have been using the resources of the Libyan state to push their own means and their own interests.
But which government actually is in charge of the central bank, or where is the central bank situated in the political context in Libya, and how important is it?
It's extremely important. So 97% of Libya's revenues come from oil and gas, and they're intended to be distributed through the central bank of Libya. The central bank of Libya has therefore had a hold on the purse strings of the state and has become increasingly influential in the post-2011 period, particularly because there hasn't been a government solution. So the central bank has found itself acting as a ministry of finance and also making decisions on who gets what funds, which is, of course, an inherently political task. Your question as to whether it's connected to the Eastern government or the Western government, well, it has in recent years been more closely connected with the government in Tripoli. However, that relationship has soured over the last year or 18 months. And that's really the backdrop for the events that we've seen in recent weeks and leads to fears over what might happen if there's a change of leadership in the central bank, or if there could be more open conflict over the central bank's resources.
So Tripoli government is in the western part of the country, and it's also backed by the Western powers, right? It's regarded as a legitimate government.
Yes, it's UN recognized. But as always with Libya, there's some nuance. So when the government was appointed in 2021, it was appointed only as an interim government intended to usher in elections. Now, it very soon after taking that mantle sought to remain in position. And so whilst it has UN backing, the desire of the UN is to actually negotiate a settlement across the political spectrum in Libya to agree a new government. But the government in Tripoli is not keen on that initiative and has sought to retain its position.
So the reason why we're talking about this is because it appears that the governor of the bank, the central bank, Sadiq Al-Kabir, had been fired by the presidential council, and a new one, Mohamed Abdul Salama Al-Shukri, had been named. Tell us about him and why his firing may or may not be, you know, the final word on this.
So Sadiq Al-Kabir has been in position actually since September 2011. So he is one of the longest tenured public officials and certainly the most prominent and long-standing official of a major state institution. Kabir has sought to navigate the political landscape in the post-2011 period, something at which he's been very successful at. Of course, he's been placed under a lot of pressure with requests for payment. He also has to live and work in an environment where there have been a growth in armed factions, increasingly powerful, who can make their influence come to bear. So Kabir has found himself in a very political position. But the truth is also that Kabir has taken political stances and has sought to further his control over the central bank to the extent that the governor now operates without a board of directors, placing him effectively almost in personal control of Libya's sovereign wealth. So supporters of the governor will contend that he has fended off some of the worst interests of the rival parties to obtain Libyan funds. But critics will note that actually what he's done is also undermine the checks and balances in the Libyan system by making power centered around him as an individual. And this leads to a difficult situation at the moment whereby if there is a battle over succession at the central bank, then it's likely to be very messy. and could result in open conflict and certainly also significant loss of the Libyan state's wealth.
So Mr. Al-Kabir has fended off previous attempts to have him replaced. Do you think that third strike and he's out, or will we see him back in post in no time?
Well, he hasn't left. He retains control of the building, and there don't appear to be indications that the Presidency Council selected candidate will seek to enter Tripoli. So it's likely that he's going to ward off this threat, at least initially. However, this is part of a broader collision course between the Tripoli-based government of national unity and its driving forces, the Dbeibah family and the governor. So this is likely to be a story that's going to develop. And I think we're going to see further attempts to unseat Kabir following these events. So that's really something to be on the lookout for. And I think this is something that the governor will be seeking to ward off by appealing to international support, notably from the US, but also from local opposition to the Tripoli government in order to maintain his position. So I think that this is going to be a battle that rumbles on.
The US has warned that replacing him would lead to Libya losing access to the international financial system. But the US at the moment is kind of distracted with its own politics. But what is their interest in who is the central bank governor in Libya?
Well, the central bank in Libya has a monopoly over foreign exchange and has access to international transfers through the SWIFT system. So a clear concern of the United States would be if that that control fell into the hands of a successor who would be open and willing to spending money in corrupt ways or perhaps in ways that would violate existing understandings. So that, I think, is the principal interest of the United States. And of course, the US is noting the rising influence of Russia in Libya. It knows that Libya as a key state on the Mediterranean coast has strategic importance. So I think it sees that the destabilization of the central bank could be a major indicator of deterioration across the country. So it's keen to avert that outcome.
So would it suspend Libya's participation in the international financial system? Can it do that, in fact?
I think that's a really good question. And I think probably something that the Libyan players are also trying to calculate for themselves. Of course, we've seen that in the instance of Russia, where the US seeks to make concerted action in cutting off states from payment systems, that this can be highly effective and it would be incredibly damaging for Libya. So this is something that the Libyan rival parties would seek to avoid, and I think would seek to ensure that wouldn't happen. But certainly it is a possible outcome. And I think also there was an undertone that potential economic or financial sanctions could be placed upon Libyans if this was a course that was taken. So I think this is clear messaging from the United States, which is consistent with their previous approach, that if there is to be a replacement at the central bank, it has to follow a due process and it cannot be simply a replacement by force.
That's Tim Eaton from Chatham House. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. We're in Chicago for a passing of the torch at the Democratic National Convention. Joe Biden has urged Americans to elect Kamala Harris as his replacement. But what will President Biden do with the time he has left in office? And what is the legacy he wants to leave? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's go to Kenya now and talk about tea. The country has been grappling with a huge stockpile of the commodity, running into millions of kilograms. Up until last week, there was a policy that set a minimum price of just over $2 per kilogram of tea grown by smallholder farmers. The policy came into force in 2021, forcing buyers to opt for cheaper and higher quality tea from other countries, which our guest will tell us about shortly. To try and sell off the stockpile, the authorities in Kenya, which is the second largest tea exporter globally, by the way, have agreed to waiver the minimum set price for tea stocks. That tea had been sitting in warehouses for more than 6 months. So this means the tea will be sold for the price the buyers will be willing to pay for it. George Omuga, the managing director of the East Africa Tea Trade Association, is among those who've been lobbying the government to change the policy. Before he told us about how that came about, he described how and why the stocks had been piling up.
The issue of stockpiling of tea in Kenya was occasioned by a government policy in 2021. They did introduce something called a reserve price for the smallholder teas. So when that happened, and the reserve price was not tied to reserve quality. So, you know, tea is bought in the auction on the premise of quality. So buyers believe that the quality is not commensurate to the reserve price that had been set by government, then they shied away from buying.
So why did the government set a reserve price for tea?
The reason was to protect the interest of the smallholder farmer. And so when you come up with guaranteed minimum price, you see there was nothing to motivate farmers to push for quality teas because the income was guaranteed.
So why did they do it in 2021 when Kenya has been growing tea for generations?
They did it because they believed that the prevailing prices then were below production cost. So they wanted to safeguard the farmer. It wasn't thoughtfully done because, you see, a commodity that you don't consume as a country and you depend on export because Kenya exports 95% of her annual production. If you dictate prices, export commodity price, then it means you can only do this when you have absolute control over the market, which we don't have as a country.
So what was happening before 2021?
Before 2021, the prices of teas were dictated by the forces of supply and demand. So the elasticity of the market, you know, is influenced by the demand and supply forces. So if you want to distort a market, then you fix one of the parameters, the forces that control market, and that's what they did.
What did you say to the government that made them suspend the policy?
You see, we have analyzed the uptake of the teas in the auction. Those old stocks are definitely distorted the supply. And once you distort supply, then definitely you distort prices. And so we advised them that for us to revitalize the sector and make farmers get what we call a living income, then it is ideal to remove the reserve price, and they did cede to this on teas that are older than 6 months. So by and by, I believe with time, they will adopt the blanket removal of the reserve price to ensure that the market forces dictate the prices in the auction.
Just to explain again how the suspension will be applied, is it just for new tea or is it for old stocks as well? Is it for everything?
Not for everything, for teas that are older than 6 months.
So when the reserve price still existed and there was all this unsold tea in Kenya, what did buyers actually do? Did they go and buy tea from other parts of the world where tea is cheaper?
Yes, you see, the tea auction in Mombasa sells tea from 10 African countries. Some of them went to India, some went to Sri Lanka, some started buying the non-Kenyan teas, like Rwanda, teas from Rwanda.
So if the reserve price was being fixed to benefit smallholder farmers, what's going to happen to those farmers now? Because now, obviously, they're not going to benefit if the reserves are dropped for all tea.
Now, that was what the government thought. You see, they thought by fixing prices, they were helping the farmer, but they have realized that by fixing prices, they're hurting the farmer more.
In what way?
They hurt the farmer because, you see, they fix prices that are not commensurate to the quality of the teas, and that made buyers to shy away from buying their teas. If teas are not bought, the stocks are being held in warehouses. That means that the income of farmers could not be sustained with the stocks being held that were being held in the warehouses. And, you know, there is the time value of money. Yeah, value of a shilling in 2021 and the value of a shilling today, they are completely different, including the exchange rates.
So they've reversed it, but then we're talking also about quality, and you spoke earlier about having a very small local market for tea. That surprises me, actually, because practically all the Kenyans I know, and there are many, they love tea and they are very, very particular about how the tea is made. So is one of the answers for this to actually grow the local market for tea?
That is one of the avenues we are pushing with government to create a conducive environment for developing the value addition segment. What this means is that the government should remove, you know, currently those who are involved in value addition, they import packing materials. And when you import packing materials, the importers pay 35% import duty, 20% excise duty, 3.5% IDF, 1.5% railway levy, and 16% VAT. So by the time that material lands to Kenya and you use it to add value, package value for the local distribution, the cost of per unit will be uncompetitive. So we are in negotiations with the government to remove those levies to make Kenyans afford cheaper teas that can increase the local consumption, because currently the value-added teas that are sold locally are a bit expensive on the shelves.
What are other countries doing in terms of quality and pricing of tea that Kenya can learn from and do differently? So you said that people were going to Sri Lanka and India and so on to go and buy their tea when they found that, you know, the market for East African tea was lacking.
That is what we have been addressing, the removal of retail prices. Then we've also advised government and our stakeholders to consider diversifying into alternative teas apart from black CTC tea. So we have other categories of teas like orthodox tea, like the ones that are being done by the Sri Lankans. So we are advising our members to consider diversifying into orthodox. The market of orthodox currently is still better than CTC tea. So we believe that the African tea producers stand a better chance because of their near organic nature of teas that is grown in Africa to also venture into that market of black orthodox and green teas. And I believe, you know, the other countries use agrochemicals in producing tea. In Kenya and the other African countries, we do not use agrochemicals, neither do we use pesticides. So it means the teas produced in these African countries is near organic, because the only thing that makes them not qualify as organic products is the utilization of organic fertilizer.
If you start making more green tea, I would definitely start drinking more Kenyan tea. But as it is, our office has got, you know, large boxes of Kenyan tea around.
Yes.
So Kenyan tea is actually very, very much available here in the UK. Where are the biggest markets for Kenyan tea?
Pakistan currently buys 40% of teas from Kenya, followed by Egypt at 19%. Then UK, 8%. UK initially used to be the largest buyer of Kenyan tea, but due to the changing population dynamics, you have heard of the Gen Zs fighting in Kenya.
I have, yes.
The Gen Zs, they don't go for the traditional black tea like what the older generation went for in the UK. So now they are going for flavored teas, and that has made the consumption of traditional CTC tea in the UK to go down. So they have lost that market share from a market leader in terms of imports. Now they are at number three.
So you're saying Gen Zs here in the UK are not buying the black tea that their parents and grandparents used to buy? They're buying more flavored teas.
The flavored teas and coffee, because the traditional black tea is not, it's not trendy. That is the reason why they go for flavored teas and coffee. You know, coffee has done a lot in terms of innovation. And that is the reason why the young men take their girlfriends for coffee dates and not tea dates.
Well, either way, Kenya's winning then, because you do coffee as well.
Yes, we do.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time and your expertise.
Welcome, welcome.
That's George Omuga, the Managing Director of the East Africa Tea Trade Association. Focus on Africa was put together by Bella Hassan and Nyasha Michelle here in London. Charles Kitonga did his bit from Nairobi. Carney Sharp was the senior journalist and Nick Rundell was the technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown and we'll talk again next time.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.